I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. We're going to talk about public art installations. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. In our third segment of the show, we're going to fill you in on the starring films for the Mandel Jewish Film Festival that opens soon in Hartford, attracting thousands of filmgoers. Right now, public art, it's considered one of the great honors of the art world when someone is selected to do a major public art installation in New York City's Central Park. You can see a Central Park installation now by Paris sculptor Tatiana Trouvé, who has studied the park's countless walkways and pathways, inspiring her to install a piece involving miles of colored ropes. And this got us thinking about public art installations meant to inspire, excite, or get us thinking in new ways. Our guests have experience with art installs in different ways. Steve Heller, our frequent contributor, is dean at the School of Visual Arts in New York, lives part-time in Connecticut, and works with students on art as a communication tool for installations large and small. He's going to be with us in a few minutes. We start with Joanne Newbold of Newbold Associates in New York City. She lives part-time on the East End of Long Island. Joanne Newbold has done highly successful installations involving giant figures and huge playscapes for major retailers in the U.S. and around the world. Those retailers want to attract attention. They want to sell stuff, of course, but they want to engage the public, young and old, in this in a very powerful way. Joanne Newbold, welcome to the show.
Hi, Faye. Thank you. It's fun to be here.
Oh, it's good to have you on here. So I was thinking about this one thing to be given a commission from FAO Schwartz, where you created this 50-foot tall Trojan horse at the store at Caesar's Palace, because, I mean, it's Caesar's Palace.
That's right.
It's still a very cool idea. By the way, did the Trojan horse hide something?
Sorry?
Did the Trojan horse, was it meant to hide something?
No, it actually was full of great, there was a shop inside the horse, and actually lots of animated items popped out of the horse itself. So in a way it was hidden because they were a surprise.
So it's another thing to decide that you're going to install a 30-foot Ferris wheel at Times Square for the Toys R Us store there. You take these things from concept to installation. I just can't even begin to think of what a challenge that must be in terms of regulations in these cities.
Yeah, that's true. That was a good one for sure. But let me say I'm so honored that you think that these are public artworks. It's so great to hear. But they're actually reactions to very direct directions from my clients about what they want to have happen in the store, which is to say they want a very big wow effect. So, for example, the Times Square situation, we wanted to create a memorable situation for kids and their parents, an experience for them. But also there was a physical challenge in the store because it's a 100,000 square foot store, and the first floor is the smallest footprint of all. So it was a way to really illustrate how large the store was, because when you walk in the door, we open the floor so that you had a Ferris wheel that cycled through all three floors. And it also was a way to get New Yorkers to go both upstairs and downstairs, which they normally don't want to do. The fact that it's really as you say, an art piece is kind of a bonus, because what we were really looking to do was to make you aware of the scale of the store, but also to create a reason to come out at night, during the day, because everyone sits at their computers and just pores over those screens, but there's so much more to life. So we really believe that you need a reason to leave home, and that is one of the reasons we came up with the Ferris wheel.
Well, I so get it that you have to answer the demands of these commercial clients, and you do this. You're known for doing this in a very brilliant way, and I love that you do that. But I don't make a distinction between the kind of work that you do for, say, a retailer and a public art installation. I mean,
that concept.
Well, everybody wants the same thing, which is to engage with the public. The retailer, if the retailer,
that's absolutely true.
Yeah,
I agree.
So, in terms of philosophy, there is there's wit and there is whimsy in the work that you do, as I've looked at it all over the place, and there is that, you know, there's a cleverness and a sense of a childlike wonder that's still there. That sadly gets driven out of many people, and I wonder how do you think you've hung on to that?
That's an interesting question. I think I've been really lucky in that the client opportunities I've had have all been in the child-related realm, and so you really have to get into the mind of the child. And really, in my case, it's remembering what I was like as a child, because I don't have any children of my own, so I don't have any direct correlation there. But it's very easy to kind of put yourself in that place and to think, what do I wish I would see when I walked into this place? What would blow me away? What would be really fun and unexpected? And I think that is the thing that drives me. I'm looking for surprise.
Mm. You did a 3-ton bronze teddy bear at Boston's Floating Hospital for Children. Go ahead.
I was going to say that was initially in front of an FAO Schwartz store in Boston, and the hospital actually bought that from them when the store closed.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
100-foot sea serpent playscape, I call it, at Avenues Mall in Kuwait.
Yeah.
Well,
that was a good one.
So it's probably prejudice on my part, but I immediately think of cultural differences and what they might be in the United Arab Emirates versus the United States. And I could be dead wrong about that. Is there something?
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, their attitude towards play and many things is very different. But again, this was really a reaction to a physical challenge there, which is it's so hot in Kuwait that no one can play outside. They do have amusement parks for kids there, but they can only come at night. And so I really wanted to create a play area for them that was also a physical workout, because there aren't any playgrounds like we know them here, where so often people take their children and let them relate to other children and play as well. And they have nothing like that there. So this idea of doing a big, giant sandcastle in the shape of a sea serpent, with lots of opportunities for curves and slides and hidden spots and places to jump down to and things to slide through, was kind of a natural idea and was very well received by the kids there. And in fact, we've done 3 others for the same client.
Wow.
In that area.
Wow.
Yeah.
This is Joanne Newbold of Newbold Associates in New York City, and she does these very successful installations involving sometimes giant figures and playscapes for major retailers in the United States and around the world, as you can hear. And that got me interested. I see this as a form of public art. There are people who do it sometimes not for commercial purposes. We asked Steve Heller, Joanne, stay on the line and jump into this conversation too. Steve Heller is, of course, back with us. He does the blog, The Daily Heller. He is our design guru and is interested. Well, there's not a topic I can raise with Steve Heller where he's not interesting. So, Steve, public art, you hear Joanne Newbold talking about this. What do you think there's a distinction between what is done sometimes for retailers and what somebody might be doing for a nonprofit organization?
Well, before I answer that, I have to tell you I can't hear Ms. Newbold on this line.
Oh. That's so fascinating.
Yeah, it's
this
weird.
Is per- okay.
But I will answer the question because I got the gist of what you were saying in terms of commercial versus muse-driven art. And I think what has happened over the last couple of decades is that many of the artists are being absorbed into the commercial arena. You know, a lot of the public art is sponsored by commercial entities. And although it's not a hard sell, it's a soft sell. And I think that what people have come to realize is that we all love spectacle. I mean, that's what Times Square is, and that's what a lot of those great displays are called, spectaculars. And this is a way into our hearts and into our minds and into our senses of play and into our emotions. And so, you know, to see a Ferris wheel in the middle of Times Square is something that we would take great joy in, just as to see, and I'm remembering this from a few years ago, down in Foley Square, there was a huge megaphone that I think Erica Rothenberg created. And that, too, was a great joy to see that thing. It's so out of scale and so out of context for the average New Yorker to come across that I think public art and public commercial spectacle sometimes blend quite nicely into each other.
So we have fixed the problem, and you two can hear each other now, which will be so fascinating for the two of you. I'm thinking about the phrase that you use, Steve, out of context. That's a lot of it. I was driving by Madison Square Park in New York yesterday, and there was a big snow globe installation, and
I saw that today.
Isn't that cool? I mean, it was dusk, and they were glowing because they're lit from the inside, and there were so many people just wandering by, adults and children peering into the globes, and I thought, what a great, they do so many great public sculpture shows in that park. So what makes something, to the two of you, what makes it, what is it supposed to do as public art?
Well, I think public art is there to take the everyday out of our everyday and make us surprised and enlightened and bring a little joy to our routines. So when you experience those snow globes as I did, I was happy.
Yeah.
You know, but in a weird way, I'm just as happy when I see windows at Lord & Taylor on Christmas, even though I know they're going to be the same windows as they were last year. There's something very special.
Yeah, I was going to ask about store windows, Joanne. You know, I was going to ask if you both thought they were public art. Well, you know, there are so many things that you could say are public art. It's the sign of a store, in a way, is public art. These are communication tools, and yet, Steve, you are someone who's always been so helpful, as has your partner in life, Louise Feely, who is an amazing graphic designer, and making me see these things as art objects, not just pieces of a commercial venture, you know, the cover of a matchbook, the sign up on a store, what the menu of what a package of crackers looks like.
Well, I think that you know, if you're of the mind to think of this, and we certainly are, you know, to me, advertising posters are quite beautiful and quite pleasurable, and you could either appreciate them given the craft that went into them, or, you know, the image that is appearing, or just the idea that you can sell a product with such beauty and wit. This is what makes it artistic. You know, whether it makes it on a par with Picasso, that has to do more with gallery dealers and critics than anything else.
Joanne, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think what is fascinating about public art is that it really engages you. There's no way to ignore it, which is just a reminder that you're living in the world. I think when you see, like, I haven't seen the snow globe, but I'll be hustling right over there because that sounds fantastic. But something like that, that really just lifts your heart because it's just something you don't expect. I think that is so underrated now in the world because that just level of joy that that kind of interaction can bring to you is just a wonderful gift.
And the Thanksgiving Day Parade is kind of the epitome of that.
Yeah.
It's getting
perfect
more
example.
And more commercial every day, but there's still the, again, context of seeing those crazy commercial characters high in the sky, you know, the size of a block in New York that takes your breath away, no matter how cynical you might be about its ultimate purpose, which is to get people into the store.
Exactly.
Well, can I ask about the Thanksgiving Day Parade? And I'm so I want to be so careful about saying this because I'm sure it's going to, you know, burst a couple balloons to hear me say this because it's a little it's a little negative. I look at those giant balloons. I've never seen it in person. I look at my family watches it every year, and so we have the TV on as we're preparing Thanksgiving, and I look over at it and I think, you know, those balloons could be so much better. So I get it that they're gigantic, but I think in the way that we today understand puppetry and subtlety, that's what strikes me about it. It's not that I have no problems. I'm not cynical about it. I love the Rose Bowl parades, and you know, I love all that stuff. So, but I just think that one could be better.
Well, I think you're right, and having been to Art Basel a number of times and have seen the balloon parades down there, you know, you compare that to the Thanksgiving Day Parade, and it's day and night. But, you know, it is what it is, and it still has that sense of wonder, and it mm-hmm. makes you, you know, wonder whether they could do it better.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're listening to the show, I'm sure they're going to rise to the challenge because the things you point out are really just the thing a designer wants to hear. Let's make it more fun, more engaging, and more interactive. But yeah, I think there's some unique problems with trying to sail those things down the streets of New York. You know, the avoiding of street lamps and all of that stuff adds a whole level of complexity that I don't think we can imagine unless we're in the position where we're actually trying to design one of those things.
Yeah, true. Well, I wonder to what degree these public art installations that you engage in, whether for retail customers the way you do, Joanne Newbold, or Steve, when you're talking to your students who are about to go into the commercial and non-commercial world as artists from the School of Visual Arts in New York, how much of it has to be big and bold and colorful? You know, can it be small and still do what you're talking about?
Well, small is the usual. And to be small and powerful, in other words, to be small and big, is a huge challenge. To be big is often less of a challenge because the enormity takes over. But we have a teacher here in the school who did a book that I co-edited called Monumental. And he takes those things that are basically supposed to be small, and he blows them up. But he blows them up with a great deal of creative acumen and creative skill. So one of his own commercial pieces, he was asked by Toyota to create an environment for their sound system in one of their cars a number of years ago. So he took two Toyota cars and bound them together with steel and made them into headphones. So when you walk through it, you hear the sound system, but you're walking through two cars.
Oh, my God. That is fantastic. That's really fantastic.
You know, so I think it ultimately, whether it's large or small, it's what you do with the assignment that makes it work. And I wouldn't call our students artists. They may create art, but their goal is to be designers.
Uh-huh. And what's the difference to you?
Well, the difference is they're working in a functional world. Everything has to function, and artists can do that as well, but they're doing it for a purpose. the outcome may be art, and it may be art now, or it may be art in 20 years, but their purpose is to design, which means they have to work in a very different way. They have to take into account, Joanna was saying, you have to take into account on Thanksgiving Day whether those balloons are going to crash into a building or not. So somebody has to design them for their aerodynamic functionality.
Yeah, I agree with Steve. I think the fun part of being a designer is that there's a whole nother level of complexity that is not something that the public is aware of. That is the challenge there, and that is establishes a good designer is they make it look easy, they make it look seamless, they make it look like it wasn't a lot of effort when behind it are all these things like wind tunnels and is it going to burn up and how quickly can people get out of it and all those kinds of other layers of rules that are really governing the design that you're not really aware of when you're looking at the object.
Joanne Newbold, do you sense from clients that the big and bold is, the usual routes to spectacle are what they're after? Is that the route for them?
Well, not necessarily. I think that scale is always an option to play with that. Like Steve was describing about the way that the sound system worked in the cars. That was a scale thing, a play on scale that was interesting and fun. And there's no reason why it couldn't work in a smaller kind of a way. But, again, it would be something you'd have to really think through. I can't think of an example right now. But, probably here's an example. Legoland out in California, which has everything in miniature, is spectacular in the extreme. But it's everything in another kind of scale. So I think it's that swing in scale that is an interesting thing to people and, again, makes you look at something very ordinary in a different kind of context.
And I would add that if you've ever been on the subway on 14th Street and 8th Avenue, there are these little sculptures by Tom Arderness. And they're just terrific, and they give you, it doesn't matter if you have to wait for a crowded train to come. They just brighten your day, and they're not huge. They're just small, and they're like taking your pet down to the subway, and they're situated in such a way that you come across them, and you're surprised. You're almost ambushed by them. So I think scale is all relative. There can be something gigantic, which takes your breath away, something small that takes your breath away, and there can be something like a miniature city, like the diorama at the Queen's Museum, which are all teeny-weeny buildings, but it's so huge in its conceptual sensibility that it does that job.
Where did you both say this is? Which subway line?
It's the 8th Avenue and 14th Street station.
Yeah.
Okay. Before we go, Joanne Newbold, you earned a degree in environmental design.
Yeah.
And so, Steve, you're what do you call what you're teaching?
We teach a master's in authorship and entrepreneurship for designers.
Yeah, so what's the is this just name? It's, business that we're talking about here, or is one... these all sound like public installation, which is my shorthand term. Is there something different about these specialties?
Well, the specialty for us is that the students can create any idea that is viable and sustainable in the culture. It could be large, it could be small, it could be an app, or it could be a product like a drug bottle that makes a difference and that changes the paradigms of what we're used to. Some things are installations and some things are not, but it's a very broad category that would involve an environmental consideration for some.
And Joanne, for you, environmental
design. For me, I think, I went to Parsons School of Design, and at that point in time, they were calling it environmental because they wanted to differentiate themselves from a classic interior design situation. So their idea was environmental, not in the sense that we now think of it today, but as a overall context, the combination of architecture, graphics, interior design, all as one package. So it didn't really have any of the connotations that it currently has.
It's so interesting, this world that you're both involved in. Thank you so much for being on the show, the two of you, and I look forward to talking again.
Thank you, Faith.
Thank you. Thanks, Faith. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Joanne Newbold of Newbold Associates in New York City specializes in designing engaging spaces for children and their family members inside retail establishments around the world, from concept to installation. And Steve Heller writes the popular design blog, The Daily Heller. I adore that blog, and he's a dean at the School of Visual Arts in New York. And we're proud to say a regular contributor to this show. Next, what is on? The starring films of the Mandel Film Festival, Jewish Film Festival, coming up shortly in Hartford. Stay with us. I'm Faith Middleton. Thank you so much for listening. And also thanks to our very talented producers, Jonathan McNichol and Lori Mack. Special thanks to Marion Roy for handling the phones on the show and doing research for us. We really appreciate it. And we're glad you're listening. We're going to talk now about the Mandel Hartford Jewish Film Fest. It is in its 19th year. Picture this, 19 films, 10 days, 10 countries. That is the scope of this festival. It runs March 12th through the 22nd, and among the films drawing special interest, the outrageous Sophie Tucker and Above and Beyond, The Birth of the Israeli Air Force, produced by Nancy Spielberg, who will attend the screening and speak. So we're going to get into some of these films with Harriet Dobbin. We do this together every year. I feel like we're old buddies. Welcome to the show. Welcome back, I should say.
Thank you, Faith. It's great to be with you today.
I'm sorry we're not in the studio together, but I appreciate you making the time to do this.
Well, I'm in the next best place. I'm here at Infinity Music Hall at a tech rehearsal for when Sophie Tucker comes back to home.
That's the one I want to get to first. I don't know her story. I have certainly loved her work. And so there's going to be a live cabaret as part of this. Tell me about what this portrays.
Sophie Tucker was the woman before Madonna, before Beyonce, before Lady Gaga. She was an incredible entertainer. She was a philanthropist. She was a woman before her time. She's really an unsung heroine to anybody in the music business and any woman who's making it on her own in the world. She broke all the rules when the rules were a lot tougher than they are today. Mm. And this is an incredible exploration of her history and her personality and her talent. And she's Hartford's own red hot mama.
Yeah, so that will be part of the festival. The opening night for that is Thursday, March 12th. But some of these films are repeating. There's a big event you're doing at Infinity Music Hall and Bistro in Hartford showing that film. I'm especially interested in addition to that, this Israeli Air Force movie, and that's Spielberg, isn't it?
Yes, Nancy Spielberg is Steven's younger sister. She's a producer in her own right. She's got a lot of enthusiasm for her subject. She actually discovered this story about the American, Canadian, and North American pilots who were basically kids after the end of World War II, who were recruited to help create the State of Israel and the Israeli Air Force. And they were came from all over the world, and they were scrappy, and they were tough, and they were got a lot of chutzpah, and this is their story. And she captured interviews with many of them who are in their 80s and 90s. And, you know, she has all the connections possible, and she wasn't shy to use them. And we have incredible special effects from Lucasfilms. It's just a no-holds-barred story that's very entertaining.
And she'll be here, and Roberta Grossman will be here. And that's our closing night film on March 22nd.
When you say special effects, what would we expect?
Well, she recreates battles. She recreates some of the airplanes. She recreates some of the fantastic battles over the deserts and the cities of Israel at the time in 1948. And, you know, these planes don't exist anymore. So she actually had to do a lot of research, and she's very talented in that way, and people are really going to enjoy some of the characters who are not only portrayed, but they're men in their 90s, and they are very unusual. One of them is Pee Wee Herman's father, who was one of these pilots.
Really?
And an interview with him. I think people are going to really find this a fascinating exploration if you're interested in Air Force, interested in personalities, and interested in history.
What would you say, when I look at this lineup, is going to be another blockbuster in terms of these 19 films?
Well, it's pretty funny that we're the only Jewish film festival in the world that has two films of the same name about fighter pilots from World War II. The other film is called Above and Beyond, Bruce Sundland's incredible World War II journey. And this is a story of WFSB's Kara Sundland's father, who was the late governor of Rhode Island, Bruce Sundland. And she went to Belgium, and she traced the steps of her father, who was shot down in a B-17 over Belgium and had to fight for his life and became a spy. And Kara and Dennis are going to be there with the producer of the film, and that's showing on March 15th. That's also going to be a great hit. One of our biggest runaway hits is a film called Deli Man, and it's the history of the American Jewish deli. We added a second screening because it was so popular, and we're thrilled to bring that one, too, to Connecticut.
Yes, this is one of the great treasures of our world, the deli.
Absolutely. And we're serving knishes and pickles, too.
Oh, that's good. Who's providing those?
Oh, we've got that from our own deli, the Crown Market.
Oh, the Crown Market. God, I love that place. Grew up going there. I thought to myself, if I was going to head to one of these, if I were going to head to one of these, it would be, it happened in Saint-Tropez. I mean, after the blockbusters, that would be one I would want to see. It just sounded kind of delicious and fun
it is,
to me.
It's fun. It's dysfunctional. Look, we used to say that the Hartford Jewish Film Festival was for Jews. We've changed our tune. We're actually about Jews. We're about our food, about our families, about our messy politics, about our music, about our fun times, and a little bit of our serious issues, too. It happened in Saint-Tropez is about a dysfunctional French family that combines everything. We've got a curmudgeonly old man. We've got some complicated sisters, some love affairs. People will really like this one.
That is such an interesting thing that you've mentioned. I have noticed through decades that groups of people as movements have gone through these phases where, you know, you want to at first put the best foot forward to the public. And then comes the phase where everybody is saying, stop portraying to other filmmakers, stop portraying our people this way. And then the movement, I think, gains more understanding and bravery and courage to be more whole in front of people. So we've seen this with the gay movement, with the black movement, and here you are talking about the Jewish Film Festival, unafraid to show its wholeness.
Well, it's true. We're not afraid of issues. We really, what comes first in our selection process at the Mandel JCC Jewish Film Festival is it has to be a great film. It has to be a premiere, either Hartford, New England, or Connecticut. You can't get it on Netflix yet. And it has to have a message or be fun or be something about Jewish culture, history, peoplehood. And we found them this year. We've got half of our films are in English. We've got so many that are unusual from Israel. We have the hit Israeli comedy about Israeli soldier girls, Zero Motivation, that won prizes at Tribeca last year. We have
Wait, what's that about?
Zero Motivation is about set in the 80s, and it's almost like Girls Meets MASH, but it's set in a remote army base in Israel in the 1980s. There's no politics, there's no conflicts, there's no wars. It's about a bunch of girls and all their dreams and their wishes and how they really face up to growing up in the Israeli army, and it is absolutely hilarious. It's a dark black comedy. We're showing it twice.
Is it fictional, or is it based
on... Oh, it's a first-time feature by an Israeli director, Tali LaVie, and it won all wonderful prizes, and it's been a hit film everywhere it's played, and we're very excited.
No, I mean, is it based on something that really happened?
Well, everyone goes to the army in Israel, so mm-hmm. all of these wonderful film directors now who are coming into their own in, at their 30s and 40s base some of their best fictional films on what happened to them. So they don't have to look far for research, but they're very creative and funny, and this one actually won a Sundance Prize a few years ago as well, so she's a director that we have to watch.
Usually in the film festival, there's something about the Holocaust, and this time, is that Run, Boy, Run?
Run, Boy, Run is a marvelous film. It's based on a true story about a young boy who literally runs for his life through the forests and through the villages in Poland. And we are pairing with the Hartford Stage, who are bringing in a one-woman show, The Pianist of Willesden Lane, in mm-hmm. a couple of weeks. And the woman is actually going to be recording a special preview of her show, and we're going to have Darko Trezniak on the stage talking about the role of art and memory in creating stage and screen productions and how the Holocaust is becoming a theme 70 years later in many different ways.
As we get to the start of the Jewish Film Festival, Mandel, in the what I call the Greater Hartford region, as we get to the opening of that, it means that my guest, Harriet Dobbin, who directs so much of this, her work is just beginning for the next year. And so it is quite a task. And each year we sit down and we go through what's coming. And so what film would you like to turn to? I was looking at Dancing Arabs. What's that about?
Dancing Arabs is a film by Aaron Rickless, and it's based on the novel by Syed Kashua, who is an Arab-Israeli writer who actually left Israel over the summer and is now living in Chicago. He's actually going to be in Hartford and in UConn next week to speak to two groups at Trinity College and UConn. And it's his story as a young Arab-Israeli boy. He was sent to a private Jewish prep school in Jerusalem because he was handpicked because of his brilliance, and it's actually based on his own life. And it's a story about fitting in, about becoming a different kind of person and growing up among a people that are not his own. It's fictional, but it's based on his life. And I think that's an issue that I think a lot of people have now, and especially we're seeing some of these issues in Israel. So it's a wonderful story about Israeli-Arab relations and what happens to people when they're in an environment that's totally alien to something that they grew up with.
Mm. We have a link on our page, of course, to all these films. And so it's at WNPR.org, The Faith Middleton Show, to see that. Harriet, it strikes me that whenever you put the festival on and these films have been selected, there's always something that in some way has been in the news, and you end up being pretty timely. Last time there was a big, you know, controversy about Woody Allen somehow, and you had a thing in the festival about it. This time I thought, oh, here we go with the Havana baseball, Havana curveball, that's what it is. Here we are opening to Cuba, and you've got this baseball story.
And it's amazing that we picked this film back in the summer, and we showed it to our committee, and it's such a wonderful film. It follows a young boy from his childhood through his bar mitzvah, and now he's a college student in Boston who wants to make a connection with the country that his grandfather received refuge from during World War II, and he also is a baseball fan. So he takes up a bar mitzvah project to collect baseballs, bats, gloves, and shoes, and tries to get them delivered to Cuba. And tries to go to Cuba. And, of course, we'll all see what happens in the end of the film. It does have a great ending. But then the news came about Cuba, and Alan Gross was released. And we said, well, we are very timely, and this is a film that I think will open the eyes of many people, because when people first saw it, they said, well, what's the problem? Well, now we know what the problem was and how the problem was resolved. And it continues to be. So it's a great film for young people, families. It's in English. It's a short film, only about an hour. And we're going to have a special program for teens with dinner afterwards.
That's great. I'm going to say two words, and that just as a tease, because we have to take a break. And those two words are euthanasia machine. Picture that mm-hmm. for a second. Then we're going to talk about the movie that connects to that. Just one second. We'll be right back. Whether you'd like to find our earlier guests, Joanne Newbold and Steve Heller, or Harriet Dobbin and the Jewish Film Festival, these are all posted. Links to these people are posted at our show website, WNPR.org. Search the Faith Middleton Show and you'll see it all right there. I have Harriet Dobbin on the line talking about the 19th annual Mandel JCC Hartford Jewish Film Fest. Thousands of people see these films. 19 films, 10 days, 10 countries at 7 different venues. That is March 12th through 22nd, so just around the corner. One that I know I wouldn't miss, I would kind of do anything to get the DVD of this. It's a comedy about dying.
It is.
It's called The Farewell Party.
Yes, in Hebrew it's called Mitah Tovah. And those Hebrew means a good death. And so it's not a literal translation, but the film itself was created by some of the most amazing stars of Israel stage and screen and theater, and now they're aging themselves. Some of them had a tough time actually being in the show. Some of them consulted with their rabbis and said, can I actually be in a film about euthanasia? It's so touching and it's warm, and there's comic parts to it, and there's some very serious issues raised, and it's done with a lot of class and taste, but there's some pretty hilarious scenes as well. I think it's sensitive to all the issues. It brings up some very important concepts and some issues that a lot of families are facing, and I think it's one of our winners. It's being played on Sunday night, March 15th at Spotlight, and it's going to be somehow, I guess, a lot of Israeli comedies seem to be pretty black this year, and we've got two of the darkest of them. But I think people will find something light and hopeful about these films as well.
I should say that there are these major awards for independent films, and this one that we've just been talking about, The Farewell Party, was nominated for Best Actor, Best Cinematography, Best Sound, Best Makeup by the Ophir Awards in Israel, the Audience Award winner at the Venice Film Festival, official selection of the Contemporary World Cinema Toronto International Film Festival. That's a big one. Let me just describe, as you do in the book, so you get a sense of this. This poignant, darkly comic tale centers around a geriatric gang of friends and lovers in a Jerusalem retirement home who secretly build a euthanasia machine to help their terminally ill friend end his life in dignity. As rumors about their invention spread and they receive more pleas for help, boundaries begin to blur and events absurdly collide. This is, as you mentioned, Harriet, brilliantly played by icons of Israeli theater and comedy. They face their own mortality as well as the moral and emotional consequences of their actions. Offbeat drama about friendship and dying and love. Doesn't that just sound so, so good? And is there going to be, will you have a discussion panel after this?
Well, we don't have panel discussions after many of our films. This particular one, we believe we did see the film. It sort of stands on its own. I think everybody's going to have their own questions about it. Some of our films lend themselves to it. In fact, the outrageous Sophie Tucker, Susan and Lloyd Ecker are going to be here on Thursday night, March 12th. And that particular film, we're doing something very different that we're very proud of this year. We have had the film open captioned for our deaf and hard of hearing community, and we are also going to have an ASL interpreter on hand for the entire night of March 12th. This is the first time a Jewish film festival has made this outreach attempt, and we've had a lot of great reception from our friends at the American School for the Deaf and our colleagues and our members at the JCC for providing this service. So we're tremendously excited, and we're thankful that Infinity Music Hall is able to accommodate this group. And it'll be an experiment, and it's our way of reaching out to new audiences so everybody can enjoy the festival.
Do you know that I have lived here all my life? I had no idea that Sophie Tucker started out being a waitress in a Hartford kosher restaurant.
She did, and she left her family and abandoned her husband and her child with her sister and went to New York to make her fortune. She's a fascinating character. Susan and Lloyd are the walking experts on her. They actually researched all 600 of her scrapbooks, and they'll be here to answer questions. We have Tuckers coming. We have relatives coming. We have people who knew her and have stories about her. She's quite a dame, and our next Miss Sophie Tucker is a Hartford University School of Music student, a senior, Colleen Welsh, and she actually channels Sophie Tucker more than Sophie Tucker. People will love her. She's going to be performing at our cabaret prior to the film, and she's actually going to stick around for dessert as well.
Oh, that sounds great. What are you, as you watch these films throughout the year and you and your team start to make decisions about these, are there ones that I haven't mentioned that you're particularly interested, Harriet?
Well, we've got 19 of the best ones, and we have the Theodore Bekele film. Now, he's from Connecticut. Everybody of a certain age knows this performer. He has been in, he's 91 years old. He's not coming to our festival, but you will be able to see a lot of his incredible talent through this film. It's the first time he's ever done a documentary about his life and the influence of the great Yiddish poet and writer Shalom Aleichem. That film is amazing. We have a story about the Go-Go Boys, the Canon Films founders, who were two Israeli cousins, and they made all the crazy B-movies of the 70s and 80s. And if anybody was ever grown up on some of these films, they will love coming to see the Go-Go Boys, which is a documentary, and it's in English, and it's lovingly told through the eyes of these two cousins and the history of their filmmaking in Hollywood. Hannah's Journey is a charming film about a German college student who comes to Israel. She's not Jewish, and she wants to do research and make her resume look a lot better, and she gets a little complicated when she falls in love with somebody, and then she discovers some secrets about her own mother's past. Berlin Calling is another fascinating story about the Holocaust as seen through a punk chick rebel and her father's story. So we also have some history in The Prime Ministers, which is the sequel to the film we showed last year about the history of Israeli prime ministers. We have a film also ripped from the headlines called 24 Days, which is the true story of the Ilan Halimi affair from 2006. And again, straight from the news, the unfortunate and horrible incidents we're seeing in France and in Europe. This was perhaps the first time that that occurred, back in 2006 when the Gang of Barbarians kidnapped him. This is not a film for everybody. It's a tough film, but it's a brilliantly acted film, and we're showing that one as well.
Let me come back to one of the premieres in Connecticut that you just mentioned, Hannah's Journey. So this is about a young German business student.
Correct.
And so she goes from Israel, from Germany to Israel. She's trying to escape her German past and everything that happened. And she takes this job. And so this is a story of memory and the surprise of one's history, huh?
And it is a fact that many third-generation Germans do go to Israel and volunteer on kibbutzim, and they learn more, and then they go back, and they start questioning, hey, what was my grandfather doing and my grandmother doing? And third-generation Israelis are also reaching out. Many go to Berlin, and they want to live in Berlin, and they want to live in Germany. This is some of them have roots there. So it's also a love story. It's self-discovery. It's a fictional story, but I think it really resonates with what a lot of young people are trying to search for, where their place in the world, but in a little bit of a different aspect.
Yeah, made-up story, however, referencing things that go on all the time, both countries in a kind of exchange. Really amazing. Thank you so much, as always, for all your hard work, and I hope it's a great success. Next year,
thank
can you imagine?
See you, and we'll see people on our website, hjff.org. All our trailers are there, and we hope to see a lot of you and a lot of your listeners next week.
Thank you, Harriet Dobbin.
Thanks, Faith. Have a great day.
You too. It's also at our website, the Faith Middleton Show at WNPR.org. As always, this show is about the richness of life in New Haven. I'm Faith Middleton.